Welcome to the Physiological Reviews podcast. I'm Kara Keehan. Today we'll discuss the review article by Patton et al. Titled Community-Acquired Bacterial Co-Infections and COVID-19. This article was published October 16th, 2023. Joining us today are editorial board member Dr. Farah Karadmand and lead author Dr. Kevin Harrod. Let's learn more. Farah?
Thank you, Kara. It is my great pleasure, Kevin, to be talking to you today. I've read your article with great interest, and I think that it really touches on a lot of important things that we've sort of overlooked, I would say, as a physician myself, in, you know, caring for patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19. So your review article touches on a lot of relevant issues, and most importantly, the community-acquired bacterial co-infection with COVID-19 cases. You really nicely pointed out the standardization definition for a community-acquired bacterial co-infection for hospitalized patients with COVID-19 were really not in existence in the early in the pandemic. And then as we moved on with the better understanding of how the outcome of these infections contribute to the mortality, then there's a better definition you mentioned in your article, which is only bacterial co-infections are only considered when bacteria are isolated from patient sputum, deep respiratory samples, as well as blood culture in those who've been hospitalized with COVID-19. So clearly, this definition will provide a better and unified way to report the prevalence of this important clinical problem. A few questions for you, and I think you're obviously the lead expert in this field, and I'm really privileged to have you tell us more about this. More importantly, again, as a physician, we see a patient who is critically ill and we bring him on to the hospital and we, right or wrong, we want to save, give them the best chance they have. So we give them a lot of antibiotics as well as the treatment for COVID-19. So do you think that this treatment with antibiotics can reduce the positive cultures in those cases? And if so, would that be an overall lower estimated number of bacterial co-infection in that cohort?
Well, Farah, thank you for having me today. This is really an honor to be doing this with you. To your question, first off, I want to premise by saying I'm a basic scientist who works with a team of physicians. So I'm not a practicing physician, so I don't really want to really spend too much, of my opinion on this and say that, it's very complicated. Situation, of course. I do believe that we're probably on a very low estimate in terms of the incidence of this, in part because of the antibiotics being on board. As you know, that antibiotics are just empirically provided to, very ill patients, particularly patients that are declining. If they have no underlying cause of disease, then, one of the first things to suspect is infection. They obviously will have many other parameters, elevated white blood cell counts, fever, these sorts of things. And so as a physician, they would, initially put patients on antibiotics. And as you know better than me, being a practicing physician, many times you're putting patients on antibiotics before you've even taken a culture or gotten results back from those cultures. Where the issue arises is that while, antibiotics are obviously extremely helpful in providing patients with a therapeutic against their infection, it's not always the right antibiotic. It's not always deep tissue penetrating enough. And so by drawing a sample out and pulling this, there's this potential of mixing, creating an environment where the bacteria and the antibiotic, are together. Again, therefore the antibiotic can serve its function, which would reduce that estimate upon further analysis. So there are instances where I think just the practice of medicine probably shields us from gathering all the information that we absolutely need on these patients. But there's, any number of studies out there that indicate that the incidence of infection is probably very poorly underestimated. I think one of the great hallmark papers was by Jane et al. In New England Journal of Medicine, I believe in 2015, where they, you know, took patients who were in the ICU with pneumonia, had no underlying other causes of disease, clearly had an infection. And, you know, only in, you know, something like 30% of those patients were they able to get any culture positivity out of these, where we know they have something. So either it's bugs we don't know about, which can happen, but is probably rare, or we're just unable to detect them for whatever reason. It's below the limits of detection. You know, there's any number. So to your question, I do believe that we are probably very barely scratching the surface of the incidence of this.
So again, to your point, it is very important for us to be cognizant of this very important entity, which is a bacterial co-infection when the virus attacks the lungs or the body in this case. So related to that, why do you think some people develop this? And obviously it doesn't happen to everyone. Your article speculates on a number of predisposing factors. Is that based on epidemiological studies or do they need to be validated? Do you think that is there a role for having an immunity against the SARS-CoV-2 with those who are vaccinated? Do they get less co-infection?
Yeah, so there are, you know, many lines of evidence here to suggest underlying causes for secondary bacterial infections to any respiratory viruses, but particularly SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. The best evidence comes from our understanding of influenza. It's not a great understanding, but we do have some understanding of that. I've always been struck by, there's a number of epidemiology papers that show that, you know, individuals that are vaccinated against flu are less likely to get pneumococcal infections. The converse is true. Individuals who are pneumococcal and vaccinated, pneumococcus being the most common secondary bacterial infection that comes to influenza patients. Interestingly enough, doesn't seem to be the case with SARS-CoV-2. We could probably discuss that more later. But nonetheless, if you are pneumococcal vaccinated, you're less likely to develop severe illness from influenza. So there are those lines of evidence, and there's pretty good epidemiology validation of vaccination against various things. But of course, we don't have vaccines against all of these viruses and bacteria, so that can't always be the case. But to the broader question of why some people will go on to develop a secondary bacterial infection, others don't. We just discussed immunity, and obviously individuals who have some level of immunity are going to be protected against these things. But immunity is probably not all of the answer here. Certainly carriage is a big issue. So in the case, again, of pneumococcals and thinking about flu, but also SARS-CoV-2 infections, the pneumococci really only is thought to have carriage in about 7 to 10% of the population. So, and much of that population, in my own personal experiences working with this, is often people who are around children. Children seem to carry a more pneumococcal carriage than adults, and so adults will get this. And carriage lasts, around 3 weeks or so. It's just asymptomatic. This is just a bug living in our noses and oral pharyngeal cavities, and it just sits there. It's not going to be a problem. But if a virus comes along, influenza or SARS-CoV-2, and you have carriage, then you're much more likely to come down with a secondary bacterial infection, we would think. There's not great epidemiology studies on the linkage of secondary bacterial infection to carriage or anything, and those all need to be done. I think probably the biggest piece of information here is just people understand there is a dearth of knowledge in this space, and there's many things to understand. So immunity, carriage, many of these pathogens are very seasonal. Flu, as we know, is very seasonal. It's winter. We've seen the COVID-19 surges. We know that it's not so much seasonal, but episodic, in terms of coming and going, whether it's circulating in your hometown or not at any given time. So that has a lot to do with. So these seasonalities have to overlap. And we do see more secondary bacterial infection in, the winter months and that seasonality of infections.
That's great, Kevin. So that's really important. And I think in follow-up of that, I want to ask you, again, I want to put you on the spot again to ask you another really important question that you brought up in your article, particularly that children who were hospitalized with COVID-19 had more, the secondary bacterial infection was mycoplasma, an intracellular pathogen, while in adults, there were only extracellular commensal bacteria, as you mentioned, that they can live in our noses, including strep and staphylococcus. So can you elaborate on what might be causing these host microbe interactions in adults or children?
Well, again, it is unique that mycoplasma was more identified in children. It's not something that we have seen, just, you know, what little evidence exists in adults that we see that. Again, mycoplasma is another kind of seasonal or episodic community acquired pathogen bacteria. You know, it kind of comes and goes, and we see this quite a bit. Immunity against mycoplasma is less in children. And so, although plenty of adults get a mycoplasma infection, but there's that. So, you know, getting down to the differences between adults and children in these settings and with secondary bacterial infections to respiratory viruses, it often does come down to, in some ways, to immunity. And children will develop immunity either through immunizations or through just, you know, experience with various pathogens. And over time, they'll build up kind of a catalog, if you will, of memory immunity against many of these things. And that's what adults have. And so that's one of the reasons why we may see some of these. But I want to caution that this, you know, may not be something that pans out over time. You know, we've only been through three seasons of COVID here. It seems like longer to all of us, right? But, you know, we've been through really 3 years of COVID-19. You know, there's really only a few studies in children. This one study in particular picked mycoplasma and identified mycoplasma, which can be hard to identify. So not all testing labs, you know, are set up as well in some cases. So I don't really believe that mycoplasma is going to be particularly special in children. Could be wrong, but I think we're going to need more years of data to really say, you know, is mycoplasma a particularly suspect secondary bacteria, or you know, are there others? And you know, I think that just remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. Lots to be learned as we go further, you know, into years of unfortunately dealing with more infection. But, you know, hopefully herd immunity will protect us to some extent. So you also summarized a large multi-state study that was done by the CDC and confirmed increased mortality in hospitalized patients with COVID-19 and bacterial co-infection. Is there any similar data available for other types of complications, such as long COVID syndrome, fibrotic diseases that we're seeing, or any other long-term sequelae of the infection of bacteria and virus?
Yeah, an excellent question. The short answer is no, particularly with regards to the long COVID and the chronic sequela of COVID-19. Really, many of those studies are just beginning. There are several national studies. The RECOVER study is the one that I'm the most familiar with, just because here at University of Alabama, Birmingham, in the Hirsing School of Medicine, we're a site for that. I'm actually enrolled in that as one of the volunteers to just kind of track my COVID experiences. And so I think many of those studies are kind of underway, and it remains to be seen how any of those. Typically, fibrosis and pulmonary fibrosis has not been generally linked to infections, either in terms of the cause of the fibrotic lung disease, which, for viewers who aren't familiar with this, is a very progressive, you know, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is a very progressive, debilitating lung disease. There are very few interventions. There are, you know, often just quality of life issues in terms of being able to maintain as long as you can, but many of these patients, individuals, succumb to pulmonary fibrosis, and it appears that one of the manifestations of long COVID is a very similar pulmonary fibrosis. Although some evidence suggests it's not as aggressive or progressive as, like, say, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis that we've been, you know, many clinicians like yourself are very familiar with. But nonetheless, there is really, we're just now getting to the point where we can start to study some of these same types of ideas with regards to you know, how broad is this and whether secondary bacterial infections are part of this manifestation as well.
Yeah, it's totally understandable that we, again, it's one of those future questions that we need to address going forward. You know, what happens with a single infection, double infections, or multiple infections? So related to that, you also talk about co-infections with not just bacteria, but also other viruses. I remember several cases we had in the hospital where we had identified three viruses, in including one SARS-CoV-2 in one COVID patient. So you also mentioned fungal infections, which is really an interesting, again, commensal organism that can take over once a lot of bacteria has been wiped out. So is it been to some extent overlooked because we always look for bacteria and you kind of look the other way? What do you think the pathophysiological ways that fungi may co-infect in patients with COVID-19?
My research and my interest has generally largely been in secondary bacterial infections. So I've only really just recently started to begin to look into, you know, other things such as fungal infections. But clearly, in the COVID-19, fungal infections became critically important as a secondary infection. It's unclear at this time whether that is because because there is some link between SARS-CoV-2 infection and fungi, or whether this may be an offshoot of the use of corticosteroids. You know, one of the early successes, if you will, of crowdsourcing physicians around the world for potential treatment options was that in other countries, physicians groups were much more inclined to use dexamethasone and corticosteroids to treat patients, and they were seeing some successes. And I'm sure you, as a pulmonary physician, says, boy, do I really want to be given an immunosuppressive compound to these people who are struggling for life from, you know, inflammation in their lung? And it turns out there's clearly evidence that it is helpful in some situations. The downside to that is that immunosuppression is a major driver of fungal infections, that as generally healthy people have a sufficient immune system to ward off the fungi that we breathe on a daily basis. They're everywhere, right? Especially if you live in the deep south like I do, and the air conditioner's on 9 months out of the year. And so we don't know if the incidence of fungal infection is linked to the use of immunosuppressive agents, and if so, then, you know, we need to probably, as a medical and scientific community, come together and find better tools for dealing with immunosuppression without the adverse effect of potentially causing fungal infections. But clearly, fungal infections were something a bit new that we had seen, secondary to respiratory viral infections, and, you know, it remains to be seen, you know, how well that plays out over time, but clearly was observed during the early COVID days.
Right. Absolutely. And again, this is, maybe we can bring this up when we talk about future and biomarkers, and is there a way to sort of detect some of these passenger bugs, if you will, that can infect patients who have COVID-19. So again, I want to go back to your great article, amazing, really just wealth of information, and just one of those that's going to be cited a lot. I really like the diagrams. In one of the figures, you do sort of a comparison of between cases with co-infection of bacterial in the flu versus COVID-19 viral infection cases. And you provide a very provocative, thought-provoking mechanism that can really identify why is it that we see differences in the mechanism of response to these two infections in each case. So, but you use streptococcal pneumonia in the flu case and staph in the bacteria in the COVID-19 case. Can you elaborate why you chose these two infections as hypothetical choices, or is that an experimental evidence behind
it? Well, so we did that. My laboratory studies influenza and secondary bacterial infections, and the most common of those is pneumococcal infections, although staphylococcal infections are not uncommon. It's actually kind of a close second, if you will. And then there are certainly other bacteria that can cause secondary infections to influenza. Previous work from our group had actually published that in COVID-19, the most common bacterial infection that we could find was staphylococcal infections. And actually pneumococcal infections were, you know, there was much less incidence of pneumococcal infections, although there were some. And again, this could come down to seasonality. And we were able to validate our data in a second hospital cohort as well. So that bias, if you will, in terms of that diagram comes from our own work, previous work that we had published. But I think the important thing to hear, to really understand here, is that first off, we have a very poor understanding of influenza-mediated secondary bacterial infections. And it's, you know, over a couple of decades of work, there's kind of some manuscripts, articles here or there that propose some ideas. Not all those ideas have really lived out, you know, long enough to be fully accepted. But when you look at the few studies that have been done with SARS-CoV-2 with any bacteria, but some with staphylococcal infections, they're really not apples and apples comparisons. People aren't making, you know, really testing the same ideas. So there's a little bit of information on flu. We wanted to put that out there because that's the most kind of obvious comparison and one that people can appreciate. But I think what we really intended with that figure as much as anything is just to show that there is a great deal of information that's just not yet been addressed and questions, scientific questions asked. And, you know, hopefully there's some young trainees out there, physician scientists or molecular basic scientists such as myself that will see this and say, oh, here's a great opportunity and get into that and start to address this, because it will take many people, many scientists and physicians from diverse backgrounds to really kind of corner this. But I think the biggest information is very little information out there, and very little of it is aligned between influenza and SARS-CoV-2 infections.
Yeah, and again, I want to just highlight and really underline what you just said, that really one of the beauties of having a very thorough and comprehensive review article about a very relevant topic is to also understand what we don't know. And I think that you very nicely highlighted that. And I hope that there are many people out there who are listening to this and say, hey, maybe I do that as a career. So looking forward to that reinvigoration of science through remaining questions. I'm sure this is what drew you into this field, and certainly will be shared in the future. So to kind of go back to the point that you brought between the flu and SARS-CoV-2 viral infection, do you think that the mechanism of the response to the bacterial infection has something to do with the viral infection, or you think that this is sort of a, once, you know, it's out of its, you know, it's in the host, it would do the same thing regardless of which, is it RSV or flu or SARS-CoV-2? Are they making the host respond differently to bacteria? You want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, so, you know, I think there's still much to be learned. But I think one of the things that we're learning is that respiratory viral infections, whether they be influenza or SARS-CoV-2, as we addressed in this review article, are really kind of changed the landscape of the lungs, so to speak, for a period of time. It's not just during the acute infection period, that period where you might have a fever and you may not feel well and whatever. But even in the days and weeks to follow, there's clearly something different. I first came into this after talking with pediatricians who said, yeah, you know, we see kids that come in with, you know, some respiratory virus clearly, and then 2 weeks later, they're back in the clinic with a bacterial infection or with something else. It's different this time, but they're there. And that linkage is just was striking to the pediatricians. It's one of the reasons why I got into the field is when I went looking for those answers, I didn't find them. So clearly we know that there is a change in the both epithelial or the lung architectural structural changes, and there's changes in the immunology. And there's a couple of ideas that have been proposed. One is that, you know, as you're recovering from the virus, you have all these mechanisms to turn off inflammation and kind of go back to normal. And if a bacteria comes in that time, you have these kind of competing signals. The signals coming from you know, the fact that the lung is sensing a bacterial infection needs to ramp up, you know, an immune response, versus the signals they're getting from your viral infection is clearing and now it's time to, you know, probably shut everything down. And so there's this competing information. And specifically, that comes in the form of various immune cell populations, such as Th17 cells, CD8 positive, T lymphocytes, these other, many of these cells that are very active in clearing viruses from the lung. They also clear bacteria. And so, you know, there's a competing information. Our own studies have actually shown that the lung epithelia is distinctly different. Interestingly enough, that influenza drives what is very similar to a cystic fibrosis phenotype. Cystic fibrosis is a very common genetic disorder in which chloride and other ions in the lung are unable to be maintained in appropriate concentrations. This is driven by the gene CFTR, or cystic fibrosis transmembrane regulator. And that what we found is that influenza actually drives down the CFTR expression for up to 2 weeks in, you know, research animals and you know, lung organoid kinds of cultures, which is what we do. And therefore, there's this period of time where you're very cystic fibrosis-like phenotype in the lung. Well, the most common manifestation of cystic fibrosis is bacterial infections in the lung. In fact, this is what drives the progressive decline in lung function and ultimately, you know, the you know, impairment of lung function that is sustainable to life. Thankfully, we now have, just in the last few years, highly effective modulator therapy. New drugs have come online, and you know, that we're now seeing cystic fibrosis patients, you know, deal with their disease, their genetic disease, much better, better antibiotics. And so, you know, we now have people with CF living, you know, well into their 50s now. I think average age has finally peaked 50. So that's great. When I got into science, it was the peak life expectancy for CF was 18 years of age.
Oh,
so that's a tremendous victory. Yeah, that's a tremendous victory. But getting back to, you know, flu and secondary bacterial infection, that, you know, we see that it, there's a CF-like phenotype in the lung, and that could be driving the infection. I believe that all of these are probably true in some level. And I spoke earlier about just the incidence of, you got to have a virus at the time that you have a bacteria kind of thing. So that plays into it as well. But, you know, all of those things I think are critically important, but we're still really trying to understand much of what's going on here.
So do patients who have underlying CF, are they more prone to COVID-19?
It doesn't appear to be the case. And we've done some of those studies, and many other groups have as well. As you can imagine, when COVID broke, the cystic fibrosis community is very plugged in. You know, there's few communities where patients and physicians are so linked, right? I mean, you know, many CF patients have annual visits to the hospital for therapy and antibiotic therapy and just checkups. And especially when they're children, you know, teaching them just how to deal with this lifelong disease they're going to have. For that reason, there's this kind of the belief that when things like COVID hit, these are the people that really quarantine. They really mask. They really do all the right things because they're living with a debilitating disease that will probably shorten their life. And so their practices are much better. There, experimentally, we did this, many other people did this, doesn't appear to be any worse. If they do catch an infection, the infection is probably worse, but they don't seem to have an increased incidence of infection. So that we're thankful for that part of it. And it's probably because of the mucus hypersecretion that they have. They, you know, one of the things they deal with is this tremendous mucus load in their airways. And that's going to be protective. That's what mucus does.
Right.
So they may be benefiting from that. If it does break through, I think most CF physicians would say they tended worse.
So again, another major area that we need to understand a little better. So you also mentioned cytokine storm in COVID-19 cases. Can you elaborate on that? I know there was a lot of studies with tocilizumab or anakinra for inhibiting these cytokines.
So the term cytokine storm comes from the sepsis field, as my understanding. I mean, this is when, you know, individuals become septic with a systemic bacterial infection. And by the way, that does happen with secondary bacterial infections to SARS-CoV-2 and COVID, and we address a bit of that in the review. You know, that's when those infections are really life-threatening, and that's why they're so serious. Certainly bacterial pneumonia is bad enough, but as you well know, as a practicing physician, sepsis is extremely critical, and you could lose patients in a matter of hours when they become septic. So the cytokine storm term comes from that field. I don't really know that we really see, so that term gets used. And I'm just going to put my bias here on this. The cytokine levels that we see with COVID-19 aren't quite to the level that we see in sepsis, but we do see elevated cytokine levels in the serum. And we know that if cytokines are elevated in the serum, then immune cells are going to get activated, you know, throughout the body, and that's going to cause some problems. Several clinical trials looking at IL-1 inhibitors, TNF-alpha inhibitors, and others have shown some effectiveness in terms of recovery and what have you. From COVID-19, it probably comes back to the idea we just discussed previously about immunosuppression. At some point, COVID-19, severe COVID-19 disease, is an acute disease where you're fighting a virus, you need all the immune cells you can. But then it probably comes a point where you've dampened the virus, but these immune cells, for reasons we don't understand, just stay elevated. And then probably a further manifestation of that is just long COVID. And so I think these drugs in particular would be very effective during that time. So there's, you know, a lot of data from a variety of both human clinical studies as well as experimental data in which, you know, the immune system and inflammation play both a beneficial effect and a deleterious effect with regards to, you know, a patient's outcome. And of course, as you as a physician would know, finding that sweet spot, right, to be able to manipulate these things is extremely difficult. Certainly, there is a period where cytokine storm and this kind of extremely overzealous immune activation needs to be dampened and you know, is driving some of the disease in COVID-19 and secondary bacterial infections to COVID-19.
Right. And again, to contrast that to the flu, you mentioned that, you know, flu infects the epithelium, but COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 can infect just about anything that has its receptor on it. And that's about a lot of cells, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly can infect a lot of cells, and that can drive enough immune response. But the evidence that the virus replicates in those cells actually produces a lot of, you know, progeny virions and continues the infection, that isn't as strong. That may be the case, and we've certainly seen instances in the endothelium where they might produce a little bit. But it certainly can infect other cells, and that's going to be enough to drive an immune response. So your point's a very good one.
Right. And again, too, because I kind of think that immune cells are pretty critical in all aspects of health and disease, I want to kind of particularly ask you about a population which I think, you know, over the past maybe 10 years, we know a lot more about them, the innate lymphoid cells, right? These robust combustion engine in the lung that can kind of produce copious amount of cytokines and fuel the first response, right? So is there any data about whether they're the main source of the IL-17 or IL-4 after SARS-CoV-2 infection? Or do you think that this is sort of, they're just one of the many cells?
There's not much evidence yet for those cells in terms of, you know, its effects in COVID-19 and SARS-CoV-2 infection or in the secondary bacterial infection that may manifest. We know from other types of diseases, studying those either in humans or, you know, in experimental systems, that those are robustly important. I would be shocked if they're not important in this. We haven't done that as my group is really not a immunology heavy group, although sometimes we get into it. But I know that others are thinking along those lines in terms of, you know, what's driving this response. I think it's important to remember that, you know, one of the things that's very unique about SARS-CoV-2 infection and COVID-19 in patients is how long, the remnants of the virus exist. This seems to be unique to, say, influenza or RSV, other viruses. Those are other viruses that can cause secondary bacterial infections as well. And I think, you know, any clinician will tell you about the roster of patients they've had that just continue to test positive for SARS-CoV-2, yet they're getting healthy, they're ready to go home. Early in the pandemic, we were scared to death to release them, right? According to my clinical colleagues, and I got many, many samples out of the hospital into my BSL-3 labs to actually, can you culture any virus on these people? Because we want to send them home, but they're still really positive. I think some of that manifests for the virus is very, the SARS-CoV-2 is unique in that it produces a tremendous amount of RNA in individuals, much more than, at least in our hands and the way we've tested it with them, say, flu. And so these things last longer. So these cell populations that you're talking about, these kind of early immune sentinels that exist in the lung and kind of there to sense danger, if you will, or sense a problem, they're probably getting, I'll say, tickled by, you know, these remnants of the virus that just hang out there. And I would really be surprised if they're not, as part of the entire, you know, paradigm of this disease that we're seeing.
Oh, so absolutely. Certainly anecdotally, I tend to agree with you that we've had many, many patients that been treated and they're completely asymptomatic, and yet day after day, they're still testing positive. So you're saying that when you look at their secretions, then you cannot grow the virus, but they're still detected RNA level. Is that what it is?
Yeah, that was our experience. Of course, you know, this kind of gets into this hospital administration, but, you know, we would try to, you know, it would sometimes take as much as 10 or 12 days to kind of grow the virus out of cultures. And meanwhile, you have a patient in an ICU bed or a step down unit sitting there and you wanting to go home. Doctors wanting to send them home, and we're waiting on Kevin's lab to tell us whether there's any virus there. You know, all I could do is wait till the kind of the cultures are done. Oftentimes, I think they got released before I sent over the information, which is fine. They were all, you know, often very negative.
Big responsibility, you know, on your shoulders. I can understand
I didn't get into this to be the diagnostic lab, you know, I'm a scientist. So, yeah, right. But we all learn from this, and right. And one of the great things that came from COVID-19 is just the proximity of scientists and clinicians and physician scientists, what have you. We've always worked together, but we all realized we could all work better together, right? And COVID-19 taught a lot of us that.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. I want to bring your opinion on another major cell type that you mentioned. And that's particularly one of my favorite cells, alveolar macrophages, which, as you know, they have a completely different embryonic and virologic origin. They come from the yolk sac and they kind of have a very different flavor of innate immune responses. And they do proliferate in the lung, we're finding out. But unfortunately, when they are damaged in response to big viral load, then there are these other cells that come from the bone marrow, monocytes that come into the tissue and kind of try to resume what alveolar macrophages were doing. So you very nicely point out to the differences in the newly recruited monocytes who I call them wannabes, you know, wannabe macrophages versus the real alveolar macrophages. So do they have the same machinery to handle the bacterial after these viral infections, do you think? Because we know that they're a very big response to killing the bacteria, right? As we handle them when they come down the airway.
Yeah, there's clearly evidence. Some of this goes way back, you know, just to looking at viral infection that, just viral infections alone in experimental systems, that the macrophages and other myeloid cells that can come in are different than the original ones that were there. You know, there's really two schools of thought. Is one is many of these cells, they're there in the tissue, they sense a viral infection, they react to it, and they stay. And then there's another school of thought that these cells also will migrate away from the lung into the lymph nodes. And, you know, they're, you know, participate in the education of the adaptive immune response to mounting. And then that new myeloid cells, particularly macrophages and monocytes, will come into the lung. And then there's a lot of experimental evidence that show that as they come in, they're very hyporesponsive to the same signals. And many people have, you know, made the argument, well, this is how we turn off the immune system. One of the ways, you know, the other is that we lose the stimuli that drives their activation. But the other is that we send in new cells that have a different machinery and react differently to it. So that's all in the presence of just a single viral infection. In the case of secondary bacterial infections, we know much less about that. And we know much less about how their response is to a second signal, this being the bacteria, the secondary infection, and how they would go about, you know, dealing with that. You know, there is evidence that the viruses, these viruses can get into macrophages, change their ability to fight off bacteria. In fact, that's been one of the better hypotheses about influenza and secondary bacterial infections, particularly to pneumococci. So, I mean, that certainly plays into it. We know that the cells that are coming in are different. But we also know that the viruses can often manipulate the immune response. And what we don't know is if all the right players are there, right? For macrophages or monocytes to perform their function, they have to get the right signals from the epithelium, signals from other immune cells, signals from these innate lymphoid cells that we were just discussing that you brought up a few minutes ago. All these signals really need to be right there and in the right place. And in the context of viral infection, all the signals may not be there now. And that's just not known at this point, although we have some evidence that the signals are different. So I think that's a really big point. Clearly, these cells are important because they're a frontline defense against both viruses and bacteria. And we know that viruses get into these cells and just can kind of, you know, cause them to be very unresponsive to many signals. Even if that virus doesn't get in and replicate in that cell, it can still manipulate it in some way. And there's evidence for that as well.
I just love the way throughout this whole podcast, we're learning about all the areas that we need to be focusing on. Again, another large body of information that needs to be sorted out for us to be able to prevent diseases or actually prevent the bacterial co-infection with the viruses, which are very common or greatly understudied. I kind of want to bring up one open kind of question, Mike, to you, and kind of ask you about what are we doing in the future? What are you mentioned biomarkers that we need to use, and we have a few of those. I as a practicing ICU physician, I can tell you that there are several that you mentioned there that we certainly use. Procalcitonin, and we want to use that to see if whether there's a sepsis. What is going on with this increased risk of bacterial co-infection and biomarker studies that we hopefully can look forward to in the future as a tool that we could use in the clinics?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And there really is an urgent need for, you know, just better diagnostics in general. Certainly one of the problems we have in the lung is just access. You know, getting to the deep lung is extremely difficult. Yes, we can culture things out of noses pretty easily. We can occasionally, you know, various techniques, induce a sputum sample and things like that. We're probably picking up things in the, you know, upper respiratory tree, but it's really the deeper distal lung that is really critical. And knowing what's happening there is really challenging. So identifying ways that we can create diagnostics and molecular signatures that will tell us that's what's happening in the deeper lung is really key in that. I think one of the things is that we know that the immune system can be different between, say, a primary viral infection and then a secondary bacterial infection to that first virus. And if we can identify an immunologic signature from that, you know, that may help our physicians. Because, you know, you got a patient that comes in, they've got COVID-19 and they're really sick. And you're just, you know, it's very easy, as you can imagine, as you do, to just focus on that. And a bacterial infection can sneak up really fast. And before you know it, this patient is on the cusp of sepsis or septic. As you well know, keeping them from becoming septic is the best way of treating sepsis. And so I think that's really the diagnostics are really important there. So there is a lot of work in the area of just kind of molecular signatures using transcriptomics of the blood or sputum or something like that. We're certainly learning a lot more about the commensal bacteria that exist in the lung, the microbiome of the lung. We hear a lot about our gut microbiome. Your lung has one too. It's not as robust as what we have in the gut, but there is one. And so we know that understanding that, we know that when the diversity, meaning the numbers of species and genera of bacteria that exist in the lung, when it narrows, that usually tells us that one bug is taking over and we're getting an infection. So that, you know, that diversity. So that's starting to come forward in terms of a possible diagnostic. And then I think the one area that's really rich for this is, you know, many of these bacteria have incredibly large genomes. They make extremely unique molecular signatures. They make proteases and proteins that aren't found in the human genome. And can we develop sensitive diagnostics to what those are? And, you know, nowadays in the bioinformatics age that we live in, can we just quickly identify a snippet of protein or RNA that tells us it's a certain bug? And, you know, over time, actually be able to develop knowledge as to whether that's a real molecular signature of a secondary bacterial infection. I think that's a very fertile area for investigation into this. But any and all of those work, as you well know, as a physician, test it, validate it, prospective study, and then let's use it, right? It's one more piece of information to give our physicians.
So proteomics and transcriptomics focusing on these co-infections provide us a future diagnostic test. So, well, that's a very positive and uplifting part of this story that I really wanted to hear from you, the experts in this field. And it's just been a really tremendous pleasure for me to talk to you, Kevin. I've learned a lot, and I hope that our audience will learn from our interaction.
Thank you, Farah. It's very nice. Very wonderful being with you today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Physiological Reviews podcast. For more episodes like this one, visit journals.physiology.org/journal/PhysRev, or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, and Spotify.